I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The stories about professional athletes suffering from brain injuries from playing contact sports like football are heartbreaking and sobering. And while concussions among adult athletes have been getting more publicity, to student athletes, their parents and coaches and pediatricians appreciate the health threats posed by concussion on young players. A new report by the Institute of Medicine calls for more research about how concussions in children can be prevented, diagnosed, and treated. One of its findings is that helmets do not prevent concussions. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Chrissy Arbogast is Director of Engineering for the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also a Research Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania, one of the authors of this new report. And Chrissy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Matthew Grady, Pediatric Sports Medicine Specialist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, CHOP, and an Assistant Professor of Clinical Pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and he serves as a concussion consultant for several high schools. Matthew Grady, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Chrissy, let me begin with you and begin with this report. What's the major takeaway we should all take from this report?
I think the main finding that the committee found is that concussion is an injury that requires serious attention. And so we need to pay attention to it just like we would any other injury that would happen on the sports field that would happen to our children. We need to consider prevention. We need to consider diagnosis, management, and recovery. And I would say there were really three main findings from the report. First of all, we revealed that there's really a culture of resistance. There's a resistance to the athlete reporting the signs and symptoms of the concussion. And that culture exists not only with the athlete, but with parents, coaches, teachers, and anyone that interfaces with that injured athlete. The second thing we found, as you alluded to, was that helmets do not protect against concussion. There's very little evidence that they have properties that mitigate against concussion. And then the third main finding is that there's still a lot of questions that we don't know the answer to. We know a lot about high school athletes and collegiate athletes, but know very little about elementary and middle school athletes.
Let me turn to you, Matthew Grady, and help us understand and perhaps even take us inside a young brain that's had a concussion. What is happening to that brain?
Well, we understand some of the pathophysiology, when there's a concussion, there's some changes that go on inside the cells. Some things leak inside the cell, and some things leak outside of the cell. And during that window of time, the cell doesn't work properly. Mm-hmm. And so if we give the cell adequate time and rest, frequently the cell can recover spontaneously, and the concussion recovers. And the vast majority of the kids that get a concussion, they rest, and they get all better, and that's the end of it. For a small subset, those cells don't recover, or those connections, the electrical wiring between the cells, which we call axons, may not recover, and they may require extensive rehab.
Do we know the difference between why some recover and some don't?
Unfortunately not. And quite honestly, if I saw an individual on week one of the injury, I wouldn't be able to predict necessarily who's going to recover and who's not. And so I think the general approach is we treat everyone the same from the beginning, and as the symptoms resolve, then we transition back to regular activity. If they don't resolve, then we transition more to a rehab phase. We have to be aware that the demands on student athletes are different than the demands on adults. And school is a big portion of the demands on the developing brain. And so if we don't take the school demands into play, then frequently our treatment strategies are less effective.
In fact, one of the treatments, or perhaps the main treatment for concussion, is rest. And rest includes don't do your schoolwork. I mean, resting the brain in a pretty dramatic kind of way.
So we think that rest is important for the recovery. We don't know how much rest. We know that if you don't rest enough, then your outcomes are likely to be worse. We have animal models that when we exercise animals deliberately, they have longer recovery times than if they're allowed to rest. The interesting thing about that is that when we exercise the animals after a period of rest, they actually do the best. So rest early in the concussion is critical, but for how long you have to rest is a little bit indeterminate. And since each concussion is probably unique, that the duration of rest may be unique. So one individual may require a day or two of rest. Someone else may require a week, and someone else may require 2 weeks of rest. At some point, we're going to transition back into not resting.
What are the symptoms of concussion for young people?
So the symptoms of concussion are tricky because it's based on age. And so if we look at someone who's 16, 17, 18, their symptoms are classically adult symptoms. And I could break them down into kind of a couple of different simple groups. So some of the symptoms will mimic migraines. They have nausea, they have light sensitivity, noise sensitivity, they have headaches, they even may vomit. They'll have some symptoms of concentration, difficulty with memory, difficulty of focus, completing tasks. Sleep disturbance is common. A lot of times people have a hard time falling asleep. They'll sleep more than normal. And emotional problems are part of concussion, especially in individuals who have pre-existing emotional issues. As we get down into the younger ages, those symptoms don't always apply, or the child's ability to verbalize those symptoms don't apply. And so what I say is, if you're 6 or 7, I think, what do you usually do at 6 or 7? And a lot of times we'll find that your emerging skills aren't present anymore. And so we can look that a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old acts more like a 5-year-old. So they're less; they have less attention. They walk around in the class instead of sitting in their seat quietly. They don't follow directions like they used to. They may complain of nausea, and they may complain of headaches as well.
Going back to you, Christy, and you talked about the kind of culture of resistance, and I wonder whether when it comes to something like concussion, whether part of the explanation is that people, they don't understand, whether it is an athlete or a coach or a parent or maybe even a pediatrician, they don't know what they're dealing with.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, because I think we've gone through a period of time over the last few years where this education is starting to emerge. It's starting to diffuse among the population such that people are recognizing that this is a real injury. I think the best analogy is it's no different from an ACL tear.
Sure.
If a child sustains an ACL tear on the field, we get them off the field, they don't go back in, and we begin a series of recovery, rehab processes. And so that same process has to happen for a concussion, and we need everyone that's interfacing with that child, including the child themselves and their peers, to recognize that. It's hard because concussion is an invisible injury.
Right.
The child with the ACL tear is walking through the hallways with a big brace on their leg. The child with the concussion looks normal. And so I think that the peer-to-peer interaction of not wanting to let down their team, not wanting to give up their starting spot to the guy that's right next to him, I think those are all complex issues that this culture issue really needs to address.
I'd be curious about how you see this culture issue.
I think the culture is changing. And so I played basketball and soccer and tennis in high school, and I didn't even know what a concussion was. And that was in the 1980s.
Not so long ago.
Yeah. And now all my students and all my patients know what a concussion is. And I coach 11-year-old boys in soccer now, and they know what a concussion is. And so I think there is a culture change. The NFL probably has helped us a lot with a lot of the publicity. And so I think what we're seeing is a changing in the culture, but we're kind of in the middle of that change right now.
But I could also see, and I have to say, reading through some of the reports on concussion, it is, if not disturbing, certainly concerning. And I can imagine someone maybe even listening to us, Matthew, thinking, oh my gosh, I should take my child out of football. I should take them out of soccer. I should take them out of lacrosse, all these contact sports. Should that be a takeaway?
Well, my simple answer would be no. I think there's a lot of benefits of sports, a lot of self-image that's great from sports and sports participation. There are risks of sports, but there's also risk of not doing sports. Obesity is a problem in this country, too, and that's the risk on the other side. Kids ride bikes, and they fall, and they get concussions.
They do.
And if we look at our data from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, in the 11- to 15-year-old population, half the concussions are not sports-related. So just banning someone from sports isn't going to solve the concussion problem. I think if we recognize and treat it and the problem goes away, then it's no more different than a broken leg, whether that's obtained on the sports field or from a car accident or a bicycle crash. So I don't want to get the message that sports are bad and we should avoid sports. I think sports are great. How should we try to make sports as safe as possible? Absolutely. Should we try to limit the number of exposures that kids have? Absolutely. Should we change rules? So we've changed the rules in ice hockey, and we actually start checking at a later age. And so what we say is we're going to encourage kids to learn skills. Mm-hmm. They can skate. They can learn how to puck handle. And we'll add the contact piece in later. And so I think we can modify how we do youth sports. But I don't want to throw away sports. I think that'd be a mistake.
Go ahead, Christy.
That was one of the specific recommendations from this report. We looked at the evidence from this change in ice hockey standards and saw some positive benefit in reducing concussions. And so we encouraged the NCAA and the National Federation of High Schools to really conduct an evaluation of other sports and other playing practices to see if there were specific aspects of the play that we could modify or delay that would have this positive benefit that they've seen with this change in ice hockey.
But I'm curious about something like football, which is a contact sport. I mean, I think ice hockey we often associate. I mean, there is checking, but there are also things like fights that seem to break out as well. But is football in a special category, do you think, Christy?
I think because there is so many direct hits in football, there is this discussion about imposing a hit count, kind of similar to a pitch count for a Little League baseball player. And while less mm-hmm. is better, mm-hmm. you know, it makes common sense to reduce the exposures, as Matt said, the challenge is we don't know what number to reduce it to. And so we don't want to give parents a false sense of security that, oh, well, my league has reduced contact to 2 days a week instead of five, and therefore that's, you know, positively impacting my child's concussion risk. And so the report really calls for research to determine what is that number. We know less is better,
right?
But we just don't know what number to reduce it to, and it may be different for a six-year-old than a 16-year-old.
Does it raise, about a minute before our break here, Matthew, but does it raise then questions about maybe rethinking practice? I mean, if it is a contact sport, in a sense, saving the contact for the game?
I think you can do a couple of things. You can start with flag football at younger ages and then build into tackle football later. I think you can change the way you practice, so you can hit a practice dummy or you can hit live, hit a tackling. If you have good technique, you're going to reduce your risk compared to poor technique. And the truth of the matter is that our best coaches are at the highest levels. And so the people teaching the best technique aren't teaching the 6- and 7-year-olds. And so there has to be a movement to try to work on coach development so that the coaches at the youngest levels are mm-hmm. actually teaching good technique as well.
And that's Matthew Grady. He's a pediatric sports medicine specialist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Also with us, Christy Arbogast, director of engineering for the Center for Injury Research and Prevention, also at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, talking about some findings in a new report about sports-related concussions in youth. And we're taking phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about preventing and understanding, diagnosing, and treating concussion in children. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Germantown Friends School, recognized for academic excellence and Quaker values for boys and girls, grades kindergarten through 12. Hosting an open house on Monday, November 11th at 8:15 a.m. It's an opportunity to meet faculty and students, learn about art, drama, music, and athletics programs. Observe classes in session and tour the 7-acre historic campus, including the sustainable Wade Science Center. Germantown Friends School open house on Monday, November 11th at 8:15 a.m. GermantownFriends.org.
The Y12K is back Saturday, November 9th, a day of outdoor fun and fitness for all ages. Test your limits with the 12K Road Race. Dress as your favorite Mr. Rogers character or Fred himself for the Fred 5K. There's the laid-back 3K walk run, perfect for families. And as always, PBS Kids characters and fun games at the Y Kids Family Fit Zone. The Y12K, supporting WHYY. Learn more and sign up at whyy.org/Y12K.
The Allentown Symphony Orchestra supports WHYY and presents international artist and renowned violinist Midori performing Bartok's Violin Concerto. The concert also includes Smetana's The Moldau and Brahms' Symphony No. 2 with Diane Wittry conducting, November 16th at 8 p.m. and November 17th at 3 p.m. at Miller Symphony Hall. ASO's Young Musicians String Festival, November 17th at 2 p.m., is included with concert ticket. Information at millersymphonyhall.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Christy Arbogast and Matthew Grady about diagnosing, treating, and preventing concussion in kids. Our phone lines have exploded. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, to ask your question. Christy, let me go back to you, because I think a lot of people, myself included, under the impression that if you wear a helmet, you're going to protect your head from concussion. This report and the part that you wrote said not so fast.
Well, I think it's important to recognize what helmets were initially designed to do. So helmets were introduced in contact sports to mitigate skull fractures and more serious brain injuries. And there's very clear evidence that they do that very well. And so we should still promote the use of helmets. The piece that's missing is we don't understand exactly what movements lead to concussion. So we don't have the data to evaluate a given helmet design as to whether it prevents concussion.
Wow.
And so in absence of that fundamental data, we really can't tell whether one helmet does better against concussion than another.
And would the option be the material of the helmet or the design or how it fits on the head? I mean, are these all the variables?
Sure. There's really some exciting helmet designs using exciting novel materials that are entering the market. And they have potential. They very well may be the right direction to go. But until we know the specific forces, how much rotation or how fast the head needs to slow down to prevent a concussion, we can't really say whether those new novel designs positively reduce that concussion risk.
I'm thinking of, you know, kids riding their bicycle, wearing their helmets. I mean, is it a matter of designing specific helmets for specific sports or specific activities?
There are important differences between types of helmets. If we use the bicycle example, that is a single impact helmet. So if you are riding around in your bike, you're in a crash, you hit your head, the materials of that helmet are designed to withstand a single impact. In contrast, in lacrosse, for example, that's a multiple impact helmet. It's designed to withstand a series of impacts over a season, over years. And so the materials that go into those helmet designs kind of deal with these two different design objectives, if you will.
Matthew, let me go back to you and talk a little bit about the treatment then of concussion. As you said, it's really resting the brain. And does that mean sleep? Does it mean meditation? And how do we rest our brain, especially a young brain, a young active brain?
So I don't think you can turn the brain off. That's impossible. Right. And people with young kids will say, you know, I need to let them do something. And so we're really saying trying to minimize the metabolic demands on the brain. So doing intensive schoolwork is on one end of the spectrum, and playing simple games that don't require much thought is on the other end of the spectrum. Going for a walk is fine. But going for a hard run is different. And so what we're really saying is take away the high-end metabolically demanding activities and kind of replace them with lower-level activities.
So does that mean watching TV or not watching TV or doing video games?
So video games have a high demand on your eyes. There's a lot of eye tracking that goes involved. And one of our research interests is on the eye tracking. And so we found that when people have to do a lot of eye tracking, they tend not to recover as quick. And that's all preliminary data, so I don't have any good research papers for citation, because we're in the same problem that Christy has. There isn't a lot of data out there. And so our thought process is that if you minimize a lot of eye tracking, and eye tracking certainly is video games, it's text messaging, it's interactive computer, that will likely help with the recovery process, especially if they have symptoms when they do those things. Television is relatively mindless. And if you're fixating on a screen and the screen's not moving too much, a lot of people tolerate that well. So if it doesn't bother my patients, I say that it's okay to watch TV. I don't want them sitting around all day, so I definitely don't want them watching TV as the only activity to do. I like them to move around a little bit. if reading bothers them, then maybe we have to take a break from reading if reading doesn't. And because different concussions seem to have different symptoms, the doctor has to kind of evaluate on an individual basis what you should or should not be doing.
But because we're talking about young brains, young developing brains, do young people have a certain advantage in that their brain is still growing and developing?
So they have an advantage and a disadvantage. The metabolic demands for the young brain are much higher than the mature brain. And so we know that in kids who get concussions, they actually take longer to recover based on their age. The younger they are, the longer they take. So that's certainly the disadvantage. The advantage is that if they have a significant injury, they're able to kind of rewire their brain much better than adults or much quicker than adults because it's growing and developing. So from a long-term standpoint of sustaining a few concussions early in life, you probably can work around those problems without too much difficulty if given the right chance to rewire. But when you get the concussion, the disadvantage is you have to wait a little bit longer for the recovery process.
And Christy, is there any way to know when we hear about especially these NFL athletes who now have serious symptoms of a brain injury, is there any way to know at this point whether it's because they had injuries as children or series of concussions as kids and that set them on the path to what they're dealing with today?
That's an important question, and it's one that the Institute of Medicine Committee really wanted to delve into because we knew it was a question that parents had. And based on the scientific literature, while we're aware of these cases that have been very well publicized at the professional level, there isn't evidence to suggest that concussions sustained as a child necessarily lead to these long-term psychological symptoms. Those dots haven't necessarily been connected yet. So every child that sustains a concussion at age 10 isn't going to have these long-term consequences. And so that was another recommendation of the committee, is that these longitudinal studies need to be conducted. We need to look at kids who sustain a concussion at 10 and follow them long-term to begin to connect some of those dots.
You want to add anything to that? And then we'll get to our callers.
Yeah, I think that the chronic traumatic encephalopathy that we're talking about in professional athletes is thought to be from repetitive hits. And we're talking about hundreds to thousands of hits as opposed to a few isolated incidents. We think of this even from the 1900s as the punch-drunk boxer. And so multiple hits sustained over years is probably not good for the brain. And I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to say that. So I tell parents that a few isolated concussions are not the same as what we're talking about at the professional level. Those guys were getting hit multiple times. And quite honestly, in an era where after they get hit, they didn't rest and they got hit again. And so our whole treatment paradigm now is to prevent secondary injuries after the first injuries occurred. And that was not the case in the 70s and 80s when a lot of these injuries that we're seeing today were happening.
And that's Matthew Grady, again, pediatric sports medicine specialist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Christy Arbogast, director of engineering for the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, CHOP. And we're talking about concussion in children, in adolescents. And as I said, the phones have exploded at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Amy from Bryn Mawr has to say. Amy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. My daughter, who as a freshman last year had a very bad concussion playing varsity soccer, and so we went through this process with that. But two of the questions that I have following that experience are, one, you know, what type of doctor should treat a concussion? That was something we struggled with. That were we fine with this with the pediatrician? Should we see a neurologist? Should we see a sports therapist? A lot of people are holding themselves out as concussion specialists. And then my other question was around impact testing. She had had impact testing prior to starting her season and was not allowed back on the field until she had gotten a good enough score on that. So I was just wondering if there's more information about how successful the impact testing programs are.
Amy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Matthew, I'm tossing that over to you.
All right. We'll start with the easy one, which is the impact testing. Impact testing is a computerized neuropsychological test. It's designed to be done in about 20 minutes. It doesn't replace formal neuropsych testing, which is probably like 8 hours. But it gives us insight into how well the brain is working. And one of the questions that we have when we're doing an evaluation is, how well does the brain work? And so I test eye tracking and I test balance, which are not on that test. And then I actually use that test or versions of those tests to look at memory, reaction time, and speed. And so as part of the recovery process, what we're trying to do is to utilize as many tools as possible to get an idea of how well the brain is working. Hmm. And that's one of the tools, but it's not the only tool. And so we can't use that as the end-all, be-all. It's a piece of the puzzle. The other part about the neuropsych testing is that effort has a big role to play, as well as other factors like fatigue. And so if you're tired, you don't perform as well in a mental test as if you're not tired. And so having ideal testing conditions is the goal, but that's not the reality. And so we don't want to put too much emphasis on one single test, but we'd like to get as much information as possible to try to make an adequate diagnosis and come up with a good treatment plan.
But it would be important, I'm thinking about Amy and her daughter, to sort of monitor how you're feeling. Do you have a headache? I mean, all the kind of symptoms that we might associate with concussion.
So all of that is part of the concussion evaluation. And so while we would like to say if we just did one thing and that would solve the problem, unfortunately the neuropsych testing is not just the end-all, be-all. It's just a piece of the puzzle.
She also wanted to know about what kind of doctor.
Yeah, and so it's interesting because for the past 20 or 30 years, no group has really kind of owned this. And as concussion has come to the forefront, multiple groups have been involved. The sports medicine physicians who started at kind of probably at the professional level and then have trickled now into the high school level certainly see them on the sidelines and so have been responsible at some level for letting them go back to play. And so they've been part of this process. Mm-hmm. There's a number of neurologists who are interested in this, and they do an excellent job. There's some neurologists who are not interested in this. So just being a neurologist is probably not good enough. Just being a sports medicine doctor who doesn't have an interest in this is probably also not good enough. The general pediatricians, I trained as a general pediatrician, did not get any training in the 80s or 90s on this. At Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we've had an extensive process over 2 years to try to get all of our general primary care doctors up to speed with this. We've developed website, we've developed handouts. And so I'm hoping that over time, the general pediatrician is the starting point, or your primary care person is the starting point. Mm-hmm. And if things don't go well, then getting the specialist involved. And I would say if you're going to find a specialist, if you find someone who does it a lot, they probably get good at it. And if someone who doesn't do it as often is not as good at it.
Anything you want to add to that, Christy?
I think the value of the primary care pediatrician is that they know that child. And some of these signs and symptoms, because they're subjective and subtle, it's the parents and perhaps the primary care pediatrician that would help recognize these at kind of the initial presentation. So we at CHOP really placed emphasis over the last few years of making sure our primary care pediatricians were equipped with the knowledge and tools to be able to serve that role.
Amy, thanks for the call. Let me see what Cindy from Phoenixville has to say. Cindy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
My question was regarding helmet development for sports that historically have not had helmets. Specifically, I'm looking at cheerleading. We have experience at home with a cheerleader who's on her second concussion. Mm. And when I look for helmets that might be available for them, that's really not something that's available. And then also with other sports, like the other caller was talking about soccer.
Cindy, yeah, let me toss that over to Christy.
Yeah, that's a great question, Cindy. I think particularly if you look at sports that females are involved in, the ones that have the highest incidence of concussion are soccer, lacrosse, basketball. Those are not helmeted sports. Right. And so this focus on helmets, while that's a piece of the puzzle, I think the other piece for these sports that don't wear helmets is to look at practice standards, how the game might be able to be changed, as we spoke about earlier, as an example with ice hockey. I think there are other ways to address the prevention other than putting a helmet on their heads. There are some sports, because of the agility or visibility issues, that a helmet is not necessarily the answer. And so approaching prevention from how those practices are conducted, how the sport itself is conducted, I think is an important question that these governing sports bodies need to wrestle with.
Cindy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Matthew, are girls' brains different from boys' brains in terms of concussion? Are girls more at risk for concussion?
We don't really know. I think Christy did a lot of discussion with that as part of her recent reevaluation. She might be able to shed some light on that, too.
Go ahead, Christy.
I think one of the issues with concussion, as we've talked about, is that the diagnosis is fairly subjective. We don't have a blood test to measure whether a concussion occurred or not. So we're relying on the athlete to express these signs and symptoms. There's some evidence in the literature to suggest that girls express those signs and symptoms differently than boys do. We don't necessarily know why.
Right.
And so this self-report issue kind of muddies that question. Because we don't have an objective imaging test or blood test that tells us whether you do or do not have a concussion, we have to rely on this self-report. Girls may do it different than boys. 16-year-olds may do it different from 10-year-olds.
Let me see what looks like Chelsea from Jenkintown has to say. And Chelsea, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
So my son was playing soccer this summer at the age of 16 and took a knee to the head and was knocked out cold on the field. And they, you know, boarded him, collared him, took him to the hospital. And it was such a traumatic event that I didn't even kind of process all of this at the time. But after we left, I realized we never saw a doctor. When he was discharged, we got no instructions about what to do about a concussion. And thankfully, our school had provided a lot of education prior to that. And so we knew to shut him down. And, you know, we literally put him in a dark room and made him lay down until we could go see our pediatrician a couple days later, at which point, you know, she found very few symptoms mm-hmm. of a concussion, even though he had a pretty serious injury
sure.
on the soccer field. And I think in hindsight, I was really surprised at how little the hospital, how little information they provided about what to do to take care of it.
Well, Chelsea, I'm surprised as well, and I'm going to toss that back to you, Matthew Grady. What do you, I mean, is there a hole in our system here?
I think there has been a hole in our system. Certainly, from the emergency room standpoint, they're not used to having to do preventative care discussion. And so someone would go into the emergency room, they'd be triaged, they'd decide if they need to be admitted to the hospital or they could send them home. And if they sent them home, they didn't necessarily always have the infrastructure to give them the adequate discharge instructions. And so then they're kind of relying on the primary care doctor at follow-up to kind of catch up to that. I think we've made that a point of emphasis in our hospital system to say that when someone comes to us, whether it's to the emergency room or the primary care doctor's office, or even on a telephone call, that we want to have a protocol or something in place to get people started. And so I hope that this experience doesn't happen again in the future, because we're going to do a little better job with this. Fortunately, the schools have been doing a nice job picking up some of the gaps. And so it sounds like we kind of did the right things and the recovery went well.
We're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Chelsea, you can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about diagnosing, treating, preventing, understanding concussion in kids. Talking with Christy Arbogast and Matthew Grady. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener's physical therapy program provides students with real-world experience in their student-led physical therapy clinic. Like all Widener graduate programs, the physical therapy program combines challenging and engaging classroom work with practical, applied learning. Learn more on how Widener's physical therapy program can help your career at widener.edu/PT. Again, that's widener.edu/PT. Widener Leadership Works.
Identity and sexuality in India.
When we started working, I asked the girls a question, "Who are you?" And the girls answered, "I am nobody."
The nobodies of India are often young girls taught to think of themselves as having no value. One Woman of India confronts the mindset of women and the problem of sexual assault next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Are you living with relentless pain? St. Mary offers a new way to help. The Rapid Recovery Program for Knee and Hip Replacements, designed to promote faster recovery, with patients walking just hours after surgery. St. Mary offers custom-fit joints to help promote a pain-free life. Details at stmaryhealthcare.org/joints. St. Mary Medical Center in Langhorne, supporting WHYY. It's your health. Expect more.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. In this hour, we're talking about a new report from the Institute of Medicine looking into sports-related concussion in youth and raising a whole host of concerns and offering a series of recommendations. It also concluded that much more research needs to be done. And again, our guests are Christy Arbogast and Director of Engineering for the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, was one of the authors of this new report. Matthew Grady, pediatric sports medicine specialist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Christy, I want you to share what we were talking about during the break about girls and neck muscles. Go ahead.
Sure. One thing we do know about how brain injuries like concussion occur is it's both from the head moving in a linear motion, like along a straight line, and rotation. And that rotation piece is particularly important, and it's the neck that kind of governs how fast that rotation is going to happen or how much rotation will happen. And so we know that there are differences between males and females in neck strength, and there's some emerging evidence to say that neck strengthening exercises can help mitigate some of those rotational forces. We still don't know how much is enough, but helping control that head movement, it's why the instructions of how to head a ball in soccer is to really kind of rigidize and align your head and neck when you hit the ball. You don't want that kind of relative movement to happen. And so that is one difference that's noted between males and females that might lead to those incidence numbers we were talking about earlier.
And talking about some numbers, this is a CHOP that the visits have increased. Visits related to, I guess, concussion have increased by 400% since 2009, and about half of them are sports related.
That's correct.
So I don't know.
It's a huge increase. Yeah, I don't know if it's just because we're doing a better job at picking stuff up. Is it that we're getting more referrals from outside of our system? But we've certainly felt it on the lines.
Indeed. Let me see what Michelle from Wilmington has to say. Michelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I was thrilled to get the floor and hear this discussion because my 18-year-old went to college and decided she wanted to try rugby. And we are 3 weeks into what has been upgraded from a moderate to a severe concussion. And as I understand it, they looked at her 1 week and they said, yes, you have a concussion, come back in a week and check with us. They looked at her again and said, oh, you're still symptomatic, some of your symptoms are worse. Now we're going to call your concussion severe. So I was wondering about how you decide what's mild, moderate, severe. Does one severe concussion equal two mild concussions? I mean, we know that four is definitely worse. Is there any way to quantify these things? And, you know, we're very fortunate because her school has been really wonderful about getting her a note taker and, you know, giving her extended testing time, et cetera, et cetera. But the other point I want to make is that the schools really have to work, especially with the high school and college level kids, where, you know, taking a week out of school is really a big deal with the volume of work that they're required to do at that school level. So do we have any way of quantifying that?
Sure, Michelle, we're back to you. Matthew Grady, go ahead.
So traditionally when we score things, we score them based on what we expect the projected recovery is. So if you have a knee sprain, that's an easy one. We talk about grade 1, grade 2, and grade 3. Grade 3 is the most severe. It means the whole ligament is completely torn. Grade 2 is a partial tear, and grade 1 is a mild tear. Unfortunately, the concussion doesn't work that way. We kind of figure out what the grade is after the fact. And so if I see someone at week 1, they may look the same as mild, moderate, or severe. In week 2, they still have a lot of symptoms. They're getting upgraded in severity. And so I always say, I can tell you how bad your concussion was after your concussion's all over. And I would make the point that the severity of the concussions, to me, are pretty important as far as return to play, how many you can get. And I make the analogy with an ankle sprain, that if you twist your ankle and it's sore for a couple of days and it's all better, you've done that three or four times, then technically you've had three or four ankle sprains. If, on the other hand, you have a pretty significant ankle sprain and you rip some of the ligaments and there's a lot of bleeding and you're in a walking boot for a couple of weeks and they do a few months of PT, and about 3 months later you feel like your ankle's all better, that's also an ankle sprain. And we wouldn't say that that one is equivalent to the three or four little ones. So three or four little ones may not be anywhere as significant as one big one. And so, again, you have to kind of individualize the severity, the impact on the individual, and a number of other factors before trying to figure out what does this mean as far as return to sports or return to normal activities.
And it is interesting hearing the two of you talk, and even going back to this report, which is, it sounds like we're in the beginning of trying to understand concussion. And perhaps, Chrissy, in part because we have better understanding of how the brain works, and of course all the publicity from these injured athletes as well. But it sounds like there's still many unanswered questions.
I think one of the biggest challenges we have in studying concussion and being able to answer many of these excellent questions that the callers are posing is the fact that we don't have this objective marker. You can't go get an imaging test that will clearly tell you whether you have this injury or not. There's some emerging imaging modalities that might have potential, but right now we don't have this objective way of saying, yes, you're injured and you're not, and then to monitor your recovery from that injury like we would do an ankle sprain. And so that subjective nature, relying on the signs and symptoms and behavior of the athlete and the healthcare professional's ability and knowledge to elicit them and detect them, I think is holding us back from answering some of these questions.
Here's a question, a tweet, and this is for you, Matthew. A tweet from Janine. Do adults who had concussions as children heal faster or slower if they later received one as an adult? And again, is that one of those unanswerable questions?
Our evidence is that if you've had a concussion in the past, it does take a little bit longer to recover, as long as we're comparing apples with apples. So a big concussion is going to take longer to heal for big concussions, and a little concussion is going to take longer to heal from a little concussion. So if you've had a big concussion in the past and it took you 3 months to recover, if you get a small concussion in the future and it takes you 4 days, maybe without the first concussion it would have taken you three. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that the next concussion you get is going to be like the first concussion you got.
Let me see what it's interesting we're hearing from women, but I'll just put that out there. Let me see what Betsy from Makunji has to say. Betsy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, have a question about length of recovery.
Sure, go ahead.
I have an 18-year-old, almost 18-year-old son who sustained a concussion 13 months ago. He was a swimmer, stood up into a gutter of a pool, hit the back of his head. I have no questions about the level of care we've received. The impact test wasn't passed three times in a row. We were sent to a specialist. He had vestibular, ocular, and speech therapy. But we're still struggling. He still needs accommodations in school.
Wow.
So it's how long? How long does this last? You know, we as parents think we've done the right thing. We just wonder, should we get a second opinion, or is this really... this is a concussion and it's recovery.
Well, Betsy, we should say, because both of our guests don't know your son, and we appreciate the question, of course, but I'll toss that to you, Matthew, in any case.
Yeah, so I can't comment specifically without doing exam, but I definitely have a few of my patients who have taken that long to get better as well. So I can't say that, oh, I'm so good that I, none of my patients, that doesn't happen to any of my patients. It does. And part of the problem is that we don't understand necessarily the severity of the injury from day one. Mm-hmm. And then we try to do rehabilitation techniques to hopefully get someone back. In my more severe concussions, 4 to 6 months is kind of the standard. So if they have persistent concussion symptoms beyond a month, usually within a month, people are spontaneously recovered just with rest. And so that's probably about 90%. In my practice, I see a lot of the people who aren't better by a month. Mm-hmm. And we do all those things that were discussed by the caller. And most of the time, they get better in 4 to 6 months. I do have patients who persist longer than that. And so that's certainly the struggle. And I, quite honestly, I feel as a doctor that sometimes maybe I'm just not figuring out what missing rehabilitation piece is there. I haven't figured out what have I not found out that I could change or fix. And so it is a struggle, and hopefully as our medical knowledge grows, we'll be better at answering that question of what am I missing and then how do I fix it.
Does it matter what part of the brain is affected?
Well, with a concussion is a diffuse injury to the brain. It's a shaking injury. The head goes back and forth. So it's not like it's the head bangs against the skull and there's a focal bruise on the skull or in the brain. It's actually a diffuse injury. And so it's a little bit harder to tease that out.
Yeah. Let me see what Rachel from Elkins Park has to say. Rachel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How are you?
Sure. Good.
Good. I'm so glad you're having this discussion. My daughter is an 11-year-old competitive gymnast. Last year, she suffered for 9 months with a headache that was daily. She went to bed with it. She woke up with it. She missed a ton of school. We saw our primary care doc. We saw neurologists at CHOP in St. Chris. So a psychologist, we did biofeedback, like all these other parents who didn't get diagnosed, we did everything. And the worst of it was that she kept getting blamed. They kept saying, this is her anxiety. She said, you know, the headache is her anxiety. And I kept saying, are you sure she doesn't have a concussion? And no one listened. Finally, one day, she was describing a symptom in her hand, actually, that didn't make any sense to me. The doctor didn't pick up on it, but I remembered another kid describing it. A friend of hers had a concussion. That led us to go see Dr. Master, who is your physician there's partner. And within 15 minutes, Dr. Master, the sports medicine doctor, knew she had a concussion based on eye tracking, sent us for a vestibular PT, and my daughter is headache-free within a month, actually.
Wow. That's quite a story. You're smiling and for good reason, Matthew Grady.
Well, it's my partner, so I'm certainly smiling. I think that if you asked me 5 years ago, I probably would have missed the diagnosis in your daughter as well. And over the last couple of years, we've been finding out that there are things that we didn't know how to look for before. And if we identify what those are and then we can figure out the right therapy, we can fix people. And so I do this vestibular ocular therapy as well, and I've found that probably patients I treated 5 years ago, I didn't treat them with this, and I probably didn't get them better, and most of them got better on their own. But it is a trick to find the right part that's not working and then to go figure out how to fix it.
And how does that therapy work? We've had several questions about that.
Yeah, so that therapy in particular is you're practicing what you're not good at over and over again until you get good at it.
Oh, okay.
And so literally you're going to retrain the brain how to do that specific activity. And so we're almost stealing from our colleagues who take care of stroke patients that if you have a stroke and you can't walk, you practice walking to learn how to walk again. You don't think about it, and psychotherapy won't help you walk better. You actually have to practice doing it. And so if there are things that we can figure out that the brain isn't doing correctly, and then practice doing them over and over again in a specialized way, we can actually retrain the brain to do them correctly. And at some level, we're almost rewiring the brain back to normal. And since kids have such a great capacity to rewire, we can actually get them all the way better, and then they function normally again.
Wow. Chrissy, you want to add something?
I think one of the interesting things about these series of questions really illustrates how individual a concussion may be, and the given symptoms or how a child kind of expresses their deficits may be very different from how a child even of similar age and gender expresses those deficits. And it's this kind of broad training of the healthcare providers to be able to recognize the different flavors of concussion. They present themselves very differently. And the science is beginning to emerge about all these different ways that a concussion may present itself. And I think the parents play such a critical role because the parents know their kid isn't right.
Right.
It's
sort of like the parent that just called
them. Exactly. And often it's that parent continuing to be the advocate for their child saying, I don't know what it is, but something's not right here, and keep pushing. And I think that that's a really important role that parents can play.
And our listeners should know, Matthew, that there's a relatively new law in Pennsylvania. There's a law in New Jersey as well related to concussion, I guess, diagnosis.
So it's actually only related to concussion return back to sports.
Okay.
And so it only applies to people in a school setting. It doesn't apply to the club sports, which there are probably more people playing club sports than high school sports. And so once the concussion's been diagnosed, there needs to be a medical clearance that they're back to normal before they can go back to play. That doesn't address going back to school piece, which is probably a bigger challenge for most of those student-athletes.
We have an email from Mark from Exton says he thinks it's irresponsible to put children in sports with repetitive headbanging. And we touched on this earlier, but again, because of the risks and frankly because of a lot of the phone calls that we got, obviously people whose children had a concussion, it does raise that question, Christy.
I think that is a important question that parents are wrestling with. But I think the data suggests that concussions not only occur in these sports with repetitive head impacts. Yes, they're on the list, but there are many others on the list where head impacts are not part of the game. And so I think it's an individualized decision that a parent needs to weigh, discuss with their child, discuss amongst the parents themselves to understand whether that sport and the positive benefits that can be derived from participating in that sport are right for their child.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you. We have to end our discussion. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
I learned a lot. Christy Arbogast, a director of engineering for the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also a research associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania, a co-author of this new report from the Institute of Medicine, Matthew Grady, pediatric sports medicine specialist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's also an assistant professor of clinical pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. I should add, he has been a concussion consultant to several high schools. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to learn much more about this program. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen. Do stay with us for Hour 2. We'll be right back.